from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, with no end in sight to California's historic drought, Governor Jerry Brown yesterday announced a mandatory 25% reduction in water usage. The governor announced the state's first ever mandatory water restrictions from a dry patch in the Sierra Nevada, which is normally covered with several feet of snow. The Sierra snowpack measured on Wednesday had the lowest water content on record. What will Governor Brown's order mean for residents, cities, and the state's water supply? Join us for Forum. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
As Californians, we have to pull together and save water in every way we can.
That was Governor Jerry Brown speaking yesterday from a dry and part snowless area in the Sierra Nevada. And California Governor Brown announced an executive order mandating a 25% reduction in water usage. That's the first mandatory water restriction in the history of California. This morning's opening Forum Hour, we want to discuss what this will mean for California. And with us is Craig Miller, our science editor for KQED. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you aboard here. Also want to welcome here in studio Ellen Hanick, who is Senior Fellow with the Public Policy Institute of California and Director of the PPIC Water Policy Center, just launched. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Michael Carlin is here in studio as well, Deputy General Manager of the San Francisco PUC, the Public Utilities Commission. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you all. And Craig, let me begin with you. I'm struck by, you know, again, the part snowless setting of Governor Brown's announcement, his talking about this being a different world that we're in now, and really stressing in a dramatic way how much the snowpack is important in all of this, because it's lower than it's ever been since 1950 and accounts for 30% of the state's water supply. On the other hand, and I want to get your response to this, the rainfall did better for the lakes and the reservoirs, and so when we weigh one against the other, is the governor coming out with something that is absolutely necessary?
You know, most of the reaction that I've seen to this, Michael, if there's any critique in it at all, it's that he should have done this a year ago. Yes, we got some rain over the winter. We got a nice burst in December and a little bit more in February. And that did okay as far as filling up some of the smaller coastal reservoirs and that kind of thing. But again, as you say, that snowpack up there is the frozen reservoir. That's 30% of the water supply. And the temperatures were so warm, so freakishly warm all winter long. 2014 was the warmest year on record in California. By the time that precipitation got to the mountains, when it would normally change to snow, it didn't. It was still rain. It was falling as rain on the mountains. And that's why yesterday the governor was standing on an expanse of bare meadow where there should have been 5 feet of snow.
Well, and in fact, at this point, April 1st, that's the day the snowpack is usually at its peak, is it not?
Yeah, this is sort of, it's not the last survey of the season. It's kind of the benchmark survey, because this is the point where generally we reckon that it's pretty much snowed as much as it's gonna. The snow pack, if you will, when we have it, is at its peak. And now we're into the runoff season, you know, where that would normally be melting down into the rivers and streams. And this year, you know, it wasn't just record low. It was 1/5 of the all-time previous record low, 5% of average. That's tantamount to saying that we have virtually nothing to show for an entire winter's worth of precipitation. This is truly uncharted territory.
And what does it mean in terms of this 25% cut? Can we do it by conservation? Because agriculture has not been hit, mainly, at least agriculture has taken some hits before, but mainly this is the urban world we're talking about here, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's a pretty wide-ranging plan. It's a 31-point plan, which is affects a lot of different things, but the direct actions mostly are aimed at urban water use. But let's be clear about this, though. It's not like farmers haven't been cut back. They're on basically a different system, these big state and federal water projects that supply most of them down through the valley. You know, they've been cut back to the bone, particularly if in California's Byzantine system of water rights you happen to be the low man on the totem pole and a junior rights holder, you've really been cut back already to the point where you may be a little bit desperate. The people at the top of the totem pole, some of them are have been doing relatively well, which is why you see these kind of incongruous reports of land being fallowed, hundreds of thousands of acres being fallowed on the one hand, and record yields of some crops on the other hand.
We're getting criticism, though, as would be expected on both sides of the political spectrum, and we'll hear from a Republican congressman in a moment here. But on the left, we're hearing that the governor didn't really address corporate water abuses, particularly with respect to farms and oil interests. And from, well, the Republican side, Kevin McCarthy has talked about the fact that we're going to have to build things now as opposed to trying to conserve, that we can't do it by conservation alone.
Well, and it is true. I mean, what you say about the agricultural sector, too. I mean, the entire urban slice of the California water pie and industrial use, I think, is largely folded into what they consider urban water use. That whole slice is only about maybe 10% of the water used in California. So if you're talking about a 25% savings off of 10%, at most, you're moving the needle 2.5%. So, I mean, it's going to have a limited impact, even if it's hugely successful.
Again, Craig Miller with us is science editor for KQED, and we wanted to speak to Republican Congressman Jeff Denham, who is from Turlock, and issued the following statement in reaction to Governor Brown's executive order imposing water restrictions on the state. He said, in 2009, water agencies throughout California predicted that the new requirements placed on our state's water system would leave us with no water during a prolonged drought. Fishery agencies and environmental groups balked, claiming this day would never come. With the fourth year of drought upon us, these kinds of policies are hurting California farmers, families, and the environment. Well, thank you for joining us, Congressman. Good to have you with us.
Michael, thanks for having me.
And you're saying, as Kevin McCarthy has said, conservation isn't the answer here, and we're trying too much under the Endangered Species Act to protect fish at our own cost.
Yeah, we've seen a number of different laws come out of the state government that have created not only a dynamic for pushing more water out to the ocean, but also greater conservation efforts. I mean, we as farmers conserve more and more. Everything is on drip that once used to be flood irrigated. We're doing our part. And I think as a state, we're doing our part. But you can't just waste water and push it out to the ocean hoping that fish will come back without any sound science. We knew this day was coming. And if we are going to send more water down the rivers, we have to store more water, and we need to be building more water storage up and down the state.
So House Majority Leader McCarthy is talking about building that, and what would that entail? What do you envision?
Well, our biggest opportunity anywhere in the western side of the country is Shasta. I mean, Shasta was designed to be much, much larger than it is. It would be by far our biggest reservoir. We just have to be willing to raise the spillway. But we can raise the spillway of most of our irrigation districts, most of our lakes that are in the mountain areas, as well as do some upstream storage with Sites Reservoir up above Sacramento. So we've studied these. They've passed the environmental process. We just have to have the will, Republicans and Democrats working together, to actually authorize from a federal perspective and then fund it using the state water users and state water bonds.
Do you want to reinstate the Bay Delta Accord, which Republicans passed back in 2012?
I think that we need to change water policy as we know it. We have an emergency situation right now. We need to be able to have the flexibility to have conveyance, and we really need to stop these pulse flows, pushing water out right now, still early in the season, that are going to leave us dry in the summer months and in the fall. We're going to be we're in a desperate situation now. We're going to be in a situation this fall that I think is going to leave many parts of the state stranded with no water.
And what about those who say that agriculture, particularly big ag, is really the problem, since it consumes about 80% of the water in this state and needs to curb, shall we say, its appetite for water to a much greater degree?
Well, much of that water policy was paid for by the ag companies that were starting to plant in new areas. Look, we're a large ag state. In fact, we're the largest ag state in the country. We should be encouraging greater food production, not decreasing it. And those extremists that continue to talk about carbon and climate control, Well, if you really believe that, why wouldn't you plant more trees? Why wouldn't you plant more agriculture? Why wouldn't you have greater water storage and actually have the cleanest energy out there, hydroelectric? We're going to see an energy crisis this summer as well with the lack of water that's going through each and one of those electrical generators.
So from your perspective, a lot of this goes back to the cutting off of water in the Central Valley to protect, well, several species of fish, particularly the tiny Delta smelt.
Yeah, I'd say that our water policy in this state is flawed. You've got non-native species that are predator fish that are eating a lot of the fish that are protected. You know, when we're doing these flows, we should be doing them with science, not just arbitrarily pushing water out as we're doing today. And you know, we need to have some sound policy behind that. But there is no excuse for not having more storage. Storage we've been talking about for 50 years now, and we just have to have the will to get it done.
And again, Congressman Jeff Denham is a Republican from the 10th District, U.S. House of Representatives, includes all of Stanislaus County and part of San Joaquin County. And Congressman, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let me go to you, Ellen Hanek. I mean, when you hear the congressman talk about the need for more storage and really a failed water policy, and particularly we're hearing from Kevin McCarthy that it's the fault of the Obama administration that we are where we are, what do you say?
Well, I think that's giving a lot of credit to politicians for the rainfall or lack of rainfall that we've had. I mean, the fact is, if you look at the precipitation numbers, they've been low. We're in a drought. Now, how do we manage droughts, given that California faces droughts on a regular basis? Storage is definitely a piece of that. It's if you store water from one year to the next, you have it during a dry year. And conservation is a piece of that. Capturing recycled wastewater is a piece of that. There are a lot of different strategies that we need to use. And the voters did just approve in November a $7.5 billion water bond, the largest single chunk of which is to fund storage projects. So I think we're on track to do some of that.
Well, let's talk also about what we're on track with Governor Brown's proposal, because I just want to outline some of this and get to maybe the thornier parts of it. He's talking about this 25% decrease in terms of golf courses and cemeteries, other large landscape spaces to reduce, obviously, water consumption. There are many points to this. I want to necessarily go through them, but he's talking about a rebate program, for example, for old washing machines and things like that to find more energy efficient machines or things that can do that kind of work, water efficient dry irrigation for developers if they're using potable water. I mean, there are a whole list of things here, and ban watering, well, overwatering, let's say, in grasses and public street medians and so forth. But I think where we get thorny are in new pricing models. I mean, I'd like you to comment on that particularly, because many people say that's really the answer, or one of the big pieces to answering our problems.
Well, I was really happy to see that pricing was one of the things that is in the executive order, rather than strictly a series of sort of thou shalt not do X, Y, or Z. I think, you know, a combination of regulatory approaches that, you know, say it's not okay to waste water in median strips is fine, but pricing is really important too, because if you just have mandates, I'll give you an example. So say you have a mandate that says you can only water twice a week. Well, if you don't have pricing that also gives the consumer a signal, they can just water more twice a week in order to, you know, kind of even out relative to what they were doing before when they were watering four times a week. So a pricing signal is an important piece of the puzzle. And I think that a lot of California local agencies have been implementing pricing strategies to try to get people to really feel that signal. And one of the popular ones is tiered rates, where you pay a higher per gallon price once you're using more than a certain amount. San Francisco has that. A lot of places have that. And I think the aim with this executive order is to get some other places that need to do it to go ahead and implement that.
But again, this executive order has a great deal of emphasis, mostly emphasis on the urban, and there's a lot of concern about that. I mean, the governor did say that there's going to be more requests for agriculture to report water usage, but in terms of tightening the screws or making everybody feel the pain equally, I was reading Mark Hertzgarg, well-known environmentalist, who was talking about doesn't necessarily matter who the man is, but a major grower who was celebrating, you know, the greatest productivity and the greatest profits and all this sort of thing. And so you get to agriculture and, you know, there's concern. This is pretty thorny, too.
So I think it's important to remember what Craig said earlier, that, you know, ag has already been taking a big hit.
Yeah.
Agriculture is a much larger water user than the urban sector in California, about four times more water. But agriculture uses water as an input into production. In the urban sector, some of our water, half of our water statewide, is used outdoors for landscaping, and often in not very efficient ways. Farmers are actually much more efficient with their irrigation than folks are in the urban sector. And that's because for any individual household budget, it's just not a big deal. It's a small share. You know, we like to say it's less than your cell phone bill, your water bill typically. So people are not as conscious of it. They often overwater. And there are ways to have beautiful landscapes in our cities and our suburbs that use a lot less water and without harming the economy. In agriculture, if you start to implement mandates of this kind, you're going to be second-guessing farmers' business decisions on how to use the water most effectively and get the best profits and revenues from the water that is available in farming.
Again, Alan Hanek is Senior Fellow with the Public Policy Institute of California and directs their Water Policy Center. And Michael Carlin's here with us, too, Deputy General Manager of the San Francisco PUC, the Public Utilities Commission. Well, maybe the most difficult thing in this whole picture that the governor has pointed out for us, Michael Carlin, is how to enforce. What are you doing in San Francisco to enforce? And for that matter, to monitor and enforce?
Enforce rationing or voluntary rationing that we have in place. We actually do monitor everybody's account. We have several tools.
We've done pretty well with voluntary rationing, but we're talking now about mandatory.
Well, the mandatory rationing, when you read the governor's executive order, is 25% statewide. And it has a little caveat in there about people and per capita use. You know, if you have low per capita use, do you have to, you know, save 25%, or is there a different number? And we've been talking to the State Water Board about this because we're down to 44 gallons per day per person residential in San Francisco. That's one of the lowest in the state. In fact, we're in the top three. We bounce along between 1, 2, and 3. And the other ones that are actually in the top 10, 8 of 10 of those are actually in our service area. So we're already down below 50 gallons per person per day. And when you look at the statewide average, it's much higher than that. It's two times higher than that, maybe three times higher than that. So when the governor's asking for 25% reduction, he's looking at the statewide average. And so when the State Water Board actually comes out with their rules, it'll have to take in consideration people that have already done a really good job, who are continuing to do a good job, and, you know, there's not much more than cut. As Ellen said, a lot of the water that is used in the state of California is used for outdoor irrigation. We don't have a lot of that in San Francisco. In fact, we almost have zero of that in San Francisco.
Well, let me infer from what you're saying that each case ought to be different and demands for a difference or a differentiation, yeah?
Yes. I mean, they're going to have to take that into consideration. 25% cut on – we've gone from 59 gallons per person per day down to 49 when this drought started, and now we're down to 44, and we're still going down. Now, where are you going to stop, you know, to say that that's all indoor use practically? And so that's a really hard thing to get people to cut even more. The other thing is, in San Francisco, most people don't see a bill. They're renters. And when you don't see the bill, they don't get that price signal. So we have to reach out to them in a different way. So we use social media. We have a big conservation program. We offer, you know, owners of buildings, you know, the devices the governor's talking about in his executive order, such as washing machine rebates, you know, fixture rebates and such. So we're already doing all of that, and we're getting good market penetration, but we're going to have to do more.
Doing a lot for the leaky pipes, too.
Doing a lot for the leaky pipes. We've just done some acoustic monitoring of our auxiliary water supply system, the firefighting system in San Francisco, and we found some leaks, and we're repairing those. And I think that's a big part of our plan as well, and we're going to keep expanding that program and finding those leaks.
Let me go back to Craig Miller. Craig, how do you think this is all going to work with so many different players involved?
Well, that is going to be part of the challenge. There's more than 400 local water districts in the state, and it's going to be up to them to implement and enforce this. But it is going to be implemented on a sliding scale. So if you're in a place like San Francisco, State Water Board is going to hand you a different target, a lower target of mandatory reductions than if you're living in, you know, Palm Springs or L.A. or someplace. You know, those districts are going to be handed higher targets because they're using more water. But, you know, I think a lot of this, there's a disconnect in California, not just, as was just pointed out, you know, with water bills. A lot of people don't see their water bills. Most people don't see their water supply either. If you live in Novato up in Marin County, you're kind of lucky in a way because you can drive out to the edge of town, look at Lake Stafford and say, okay, the reservoir's low or the reservoir's high. If you live in San Francisco, your water is coming from Hetch Hetchy way up in, you know, Yosemite. And most places in California are like that. Ultimately, their water supply comes from distant places. And it's really hard to drive home the point that we're in a serious drought. If it rains when you open your faucet and water comes out, it's hard not to assume that things are okay. So I think a lot of what the governor is trying to do here is change the mentality in California and get people to adopt a kind of water-saving ethic that maybe has been lacking.
Yeah, he certainly was talking about a new era and all of that sort of thing.
Well, he was exasperated. I hate to ascribe emotions to the governor, but you could almost hear the exasperation in his voice when he said, look, last year I asked for voluntary reductions to get 20%, and I got half of that. Not good enough, guys. And so he's taken it to the next level.
Do you think, particularly when you hear Michael Carlin talking about how well they're doing or how well they've done here in San Francisco, there's going to be wiggle room for those who already conserve?
Yeah, I think that's where the sliding scale comes in, you know, is that the State Water Board has got to sit down and do the math. And while the average may be 25%, you're going to get the districts, the local water agencies are going to get different targets depending on how their water consumers are already doing. And it's important to point out, I think, here that there's a kind of perverse incentive for water agencies in California, the way we've been doing things. Their business model, if you will, is still tied to selling water. And so if they are successful in their conservation efforts and people use less water, that means less revenue coming to the water agency for them to build out new projects and pay their staff and so on and so forth. And so a lot of people are calling for decoupling in the same way that happened in the electricity industry, so that there isn't this hesitancy on the part of local agencies to promote conservation, knowing that, and they're kind of cutting their own throats if they do.
Michael Carlin, get a quick response from you on that.
Craig's pointed out really a part of this whole drought that most people don't understand. Our revenues are down. And as such, you know, we're looking at our rates. Right now we have a rate package in San Francisco that we're comfortable with, that we can live through the drought. But you hear about large rate increases, and that's something we can talk about.
Well, the other thing about the governor's speech is we're in it for the long haul, folks. And with climate change impacting all this, it's grim. But let me invite those of you who are listening to join this program. I'm sure you have questions or comments about the 25% mandatory, now the first in the state of California, reduction. And you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. With no end in sight to California's historic drought, Governor Jerry Brown announced yesterday a mandatory 25% reduction in water usage. And we're talking about the governor's mandate, what it'll mean. It's the first time in California history that there has been a mandate of this sort. We asked our listeners for thoughts on mandated restrictions. And coming in from our Facebook page, let me read a few of those. Ellen writes, in order for me to really support the governor on this, he needs to demonstrate that this means no more fracking, no more water bottle companies using our water for their profit and restricting the wasteful agricultural products. Another listener writes, I like Brown generally, but this is a failure of leadership and continued failure of government. When agriculture accounts for 80% of direct water use in the state, a 25% reduction on the remaining residential and commercial consumption is a proverbial drop in the bucket. 10% of California's water gets used up growing almonds, just almonds. Ann writes, I'd like to say better late than never, but maybe it's too late. I'm shocked it took this long, and the real problems and the real problem makers are not being addressed even now. California is its own worst enemy. Susan asks, my question is, when do the restrictions go into effect, or will it be up to the individual water districts to decide? Well, let me go to you on that, Michael Carlin. It is already in effect technically, isn't it?
It's in effect technically, but the State Water Board has to come out with some guidelines on how they're going to implement it, and we expect that to happen over the next couple of months. And so I would anticipate by July 1st we'd have those rules in place.
And again, we do welcome your involvement in this discussion. Particularly like to hear from some of you in terms of how you feel this will affect you, whether at home or in business. And again, our toll-free number, all lines are occupied, but feel free to grab one when it becomes unoccupied, 866-733-6786, or our email address is forum@kqed.org. And you can post questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's at @KQEDForum. John writes, I don't water my lawn at all, don't wash my car. I agree completely with the sentiments that if we want to be serious about saving water, we need to stop fracking, stop boiling water to sell out of state, find ways to reduce agriculture use. But I also think that instead of declaring everybody cut their water use by 25%, we can be much more targeted in our reduction. How about no watering lawns, period? How about mandatory gray water systems in new construction and incentives for people who install them in their homes? And how about requiring water-intensive enterprises like golf courses to use non-potable water? Well, whenever we do a program like this, we get lots of and many of them really quite good and illuminating suggestions from listeners, and feel free to add your voices to this. But I want to go back before I go to your calls to Ellen Hanick, who again is senior fellow with the Public Policy Institute of California and directs their Water Policy Center. We mentioned, and this is really, Craig Miller's terrain, to put it mildly, but we mentioned climate change before. Talk about this trajectory of climate change. I mean, it's not necessarily the culpability does not lie with climate change here.
Well, there have been some studies looking at this drought to see whether there's evidence that it's caused by climate change. And the studies come out on with some different interpretations of that. But I think what everybody looking at the data could agree on is that what we're witnessing is very much what climate change projects we're going to be experiencing more and more of, climate change models. So, you know, one of the things that we really have a lot of consensus on in the modeling for California is that it's going to be getting warmer and our snowpack is going to be shrinking. And this year, we're at the lowest snowpack in the range that if you look out to 2100, the models are suggesting we're going to be having on average. So we're experiencing that kind of year. And it's because it's been so warm. So you combine warm weather with low rainfall, and you get what the future is going to be looking like more and more. And so that's one of the reasons why I think we have to really be preparing not just to get through this drought, but also make the investments that are going to make it possible for us to get through future droughts that are going to look like this.
Want to add anything to that, Craig Miller?
Well, I think, first of all, I just want to reiterate, I hope everybody heard what Ellen just said, that the model's going out to 2100 this year. Average. This is now the average year when you project out that far. Yeah, there are people like Noah Diffenbaugh at Stanford, who point out that not only do all of the projections indicate that we're kind of getting a glimpse of the future here, but it's not only going to have a shrinking snowpack, but it's going to get warmer. That's one of the reasons. One of the main reasons for the shrinking snowpack is that the droughts that we have probably going to be longer and more intense. This drought was already considered an epic drought just 3 years in. We've had longer droughts, but this is a particularly warm one, and high temperatures exacerbate almost every aspect of a drought. They just bake whatever moisture is in the soil out and make things worse. And so that, in another sense, is how we're kind of seeing the future here.
And we're going to go see what our listeners have to say. We begin, Dick, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for the time. I grew up in Modesto. I worked in the Westlands Water District for 15 years. I was a field biology major in college. I commercial salmon fished, and I own a restaurant in Petaluma now. And I'm kind of well-versed in the California water situation, and we really don't have a problem. All we need to do to rebut Mr. Dunham, the legislator, is take about 5 or 10% of all that lousy soil in Westlands that's selenium-laced out of production, put 10% of that water back into the rest of the state. Since farmers are getting 80% of the water in California right now, we all could have plenty of water. We just need to get rid of some of this land that's in production. And instead of what he wants to do, which is cut the flows off through the Delta and therefore put 35,000 salmon fishermen and sport industries out of business, we could take about 5 large farming corporations, buy them out, take their water rights back, They never did finish paying for the California Water Project. In fact, they still owe $250 million of it from the 50s. So I think all we need to do is get a big chalkboard and decide as a state who really should get the water and what it should be used for. But what we're doing right now is a bunch of BS. And so I think there's a solution to our water problem.
Dick, I thank you for that call. Alan Hannock.
So, you know, the caller suggests something that is an interesting idea and one that has been discussed. And it's the idea of paying to take some land out of production and retire not only the land, but also
eminent domain.
Water.
You could do it.
You could do it. You could negotiate it. And actually, there has been some of that already happening on a smaller scale. And, you know, we've written and continue to think that can be a piece of the solution. Where I disagree with the caller is in thinking that there is one single solution. There really needs to be a kind of, what Felicia Marcus of the State Water Board likes to say, an all-of-the-above approach, because there's not a silver bullet solution to this problem.
Let me get Frank on next. Frank, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Good morning. I totally agree with the 80-20 farmers versus urban issue, but I'd like to focus on the fairness of the restriction as applied to urban people. Has there been any thinking about those of the citizens who've already worked very hard to cut their usage? And by that I mean to use as a baseline some average urban user number so that 25% doesn't fall equally on somebody who waters their lawn 8 hours a day and somebody who's already shaving in the toothpaste water?
It's an important question, Frank, and I'd like to dovetail it and go to Michael Carlin on this with an email that I'm looking at from a listener named Carly who writes, "The gentleman, meaning you, Michael, stated that the city of San Francisco does virtually none of that in reference to outdoor water usage. I live in the Panhandle. Just this morning, I saw multiple sprinklers on in Golden Gate Park next to a parking lot, not even in a heavily traveled or tourist location. Why is this still happening?"
So the caller identifies that the sliding scale needs to be put in place. There are already people that are actually conserving very well. And also, you know, we do have outdoor watering of our recreational areas. And that, if you look at the governor's executive order, that was kind of left out of the executive order because recreational areas provide large public values for people to enjoy the outdoors and such. So while they did see irrigation taking place in the Panhandle this morning, we are working with our Recreation and Park Department. They have reduced their water usage significantly here in San Francisco. They're down to watering 2 days a week, and we actually monitor the number of hours they water. So while you do see some, we see that happening. But I was talking about individuals, you know, outdoor irrigation in San Francisco, people that have lawns in San Francisco outside. They serve no purpose. They're just for aesthetics. Those are the ones we're going to target and need to go after.
Ellen, let me go back to you, Ellen Hannock, with a listener, Adam, who writes, "Given that so much of our nation's agricultural products come from California, do you think that the governor has leverage with other states and nations to ask them for help in relieving our drought issues? Specifically, I'm thinking about asking for money from other states to invest in new ways of water-efficient growing, maybe even so far as a national pipeline system to ship water from states that have too much to the states that are suffering from drought. I would think California has leverage in this area. I mean, do consumers really want to pay $20 a pound for almonds?"
Well, you know, California is an agricultural powerhouse. There's no doubt about it. Largest ag state in the country, major exporter of a lot of different commodities. You know, almost all of the world market for almonds, pistachios, number of other things. But if you look at California agriculture overall, what you also see is that a lot of the water goes toward crops that do not generate a lot of profit and a lot of revenue per gallon of water used. And so, you know, we could make relatively small cuts in ag water use over time and continue to produce most of the commodities that we do produce now, probably more of some of the higher value products like fruits, nuts, and vegetables. And that's probably the direction that we need to go. You have to remember that water is really heavy. So moving it from someplace really far away to California is not easy.
No. We're getting a lot of questions about food prices, too. I mean, you anticipate that those will escalate?
Food prices have been – commodity prices in general have been high. And that's one of the reasons – one of the things that actually has cushioned farmers during this drought, because the prices have happened to have been high. There's not – evidence so far that the drought has really impacted the prices of food in the grocery stores. You know, it's quite possible if the drought continues and gets more severe that could happen. But that's not really the issue at this point.
What about rents, Michael Carlin? Heather writes, if water rates rise, can landlords raise rent? We're not talking about necessarily rent control here, based on the increase. And what can renters do with out-of-date wasteful appliances? How can we encourage incentives for landlords that may have units to update with water-efficient toilets, dishwaters, et cetera, and the rebates are not that large, and it can still be a significant amount of money to put out, especially in installation labor.
That's true. So rates are – there's a certain amount that actually is a pass-through to the tenant when we do rate increases, but mostly it's absorbed by the landlord. As far as, like, you know, multifamily residences where, you know, there's lots of tenants – that's the market we're targeting now, and we have programs, incentive programs to replace their old fixtures and such. And we even have some grant programs to help out those that, you know, can't afford everything, that we can actually install the devices for them. So there's lots of ways to do that. We just need to find out who they are and have them come in and talk to us.
And let me go to more of your calls. We welcome a caller from up in Mount Shasta. Bill, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. We're in Mount Shasta. We're at the top of the watershed in California, and we're presently opposed, or many people in the community are opposed to a crystal geyser water bottling plant that's going in. And I have written Governor Brown numerous emails, and I never get any responses. So I'm really angry with him for not being responded to. And this is just not right that the governor and state officials keep asking individuals to conserve, and yet we entertain this idea of water bottling and making these absurd 10% juice drinks that are supposedly healthy for Americans, and It's not right, and something needs to be done about this, and the governor just needs to get firm and say, this is not going to happen, that we're not going to ask individuals to conserve, and yet corporations have a free hand and waste and send this water to other parts of the world, and that's my comment.
Well, I appreciate the comment, Bill, and I thank you for it. And it brings up, a whole number of issues, really, related issues. Craig Miller, I'm looking at a tweet here, for example, from a listener who says, while Californians deal with those, restrictions on oil companies using millions of gallons of chemical-laden water for fracking is not moving forward on any at least foreseeable track. Lots of comments about fracking water use, Craig.
Yeah, you will get a lot of comments on that. And while by and large, in California, the fracking process does consume less water than it does elsewhere in the country, it still uses a lot of water. Although right now, you know, with the price of oil, you know, that oil and gas activity in general is kind of depressed, and I don't know if we're going to see the boom, at least anytime soon, that people have been predicting. But there's also an issue, of course, with, you know, injecting wastewater from gas and oil operations back into the ground, possibly into aquifers that we could be drinking from. And state agencies have basically already admitted that they were kind of asleep at the switch on this. And they've been ordered to do better and monitor this more carefully. And while we're on the subject, I just want to say, I hear, you know, there's a lot of resentment toward the amount of water that is used in farm country. I think the real crisis in farm country, and some of that is justified, I think, by the way, particularly with some of the legacy subsidies and so forth, but not all of it is justified. I think the real crisis right now is what happens in this situation when farmers go to Plan B, when they get cut back on surface water. They start drilling for groundwater, and that
I was just
is
about
much
to ask you for
the,
about
process
that.
As the snowpack. Yeah.
We've already gone up in groundwater use from, I think, 40% to 60%, and there's just so much of it available. Plus, the aquifers, as you suggested, are collapsing under that pressure. Are they not?
Yeah, there has been so much overdraft in some parts of the Central Valley where the valley is actually sinking more than it already is. And Ellen can speak to this, too.
Yeah, let's hear from Ellen.
Well, you know, this is one of the opportunities that California has really seized as a result of this drought is to start getting our groundwater management house in order. There was historic legislation enacted in September to basically say that we now have to start managing groundwater basins across the state in order to get them to sustainable levels. And, you know, I can just say that was enacted 100 years after the modern water code was enacted. And that water code back in 1914 left groundwater out because it was just considered too hard and too contentious to do. Now we have groundwater legislation, and this legislation gives a lot of authority to local entities, to folks on the ground who live above aquifers, to put together a plan to figure out how they're going to manage it. The state only steps in if they fail to do that. So it's really a good formula.
Well, I need to add something here, though, because Governor Brown is on record as saying we need more scientific data and empiricism with respect to fracking, and fracking can get into the groundwater. I mean, there's very little doubt about that at this point. I mean, when he makes analogies, as he does, for example, all the effect of automobiles and analogizes that to fracking and says, you know, let's get rid of cars if we want to get rid of fracking. Doesn't really make sense when you're concerned about the groundwater. I guess I'm editorializing here for a moment, or at least framing it in ways that I understand it. Let me get another caller on in the meantime. Judith, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
I have a couple of comments. First of all, the one about the weight of water. I'm wondering, you know, oil is also heavy to move via pipelines. We seem to manage commercially and financially to move oil. The idea about moving water between states that have significantly more to significantly less could perhaps be viewed in that regard. We would be putting many people to work. It would be less polluting, and we would have no concern about accidents that cause severe problems. Granted, we could build more reservoirs, but I wish we would consider the web of life that is really important to all of us. I live in, obviously, Sonoma County. I drive professionally both in Napa and Sonoma County. And I also have seen a lot of wildlife die because of the drought. So I believe we should take that into consideration also. Secondly, because I do live up here in wine country, I really do have a question about why we allow vineyards to constantly replant old vines and plant new vines. And I personally see this quite a bit. I realize that wine produces a financial reward for the counties and the states. However, they're not a crop that we need to eat. And obviously, we have a glut of wine. So those are my basic comments.
Well, we thank you for those comments, Judith. And actually, I'm looking at a tweet here from a listener who says, why can't we buy water from other states where they have surplus? This keeps coming back. I mean, she says, you know, oil's pretty heavy too, so why can't we have water shipped? But let's talk about the vineyards. And Craig, let me go to you on this, because last time we talked about the drought, there was a lot of concern about water usage up in Sonoma and Napa counties, and for that matter, down in the southern part of the state where wine is produced.
Well, the glib answer to the weight question, of course, is that when the price of water equals the price of oil, you'll start to see more pipelines and people moving it around from state to state.
Yeah.
Moving water long distances is a political third rail. I mean, there have been proposals since the 1930s for tapping water from as far away as the Columbia River, you know, up in Washington State. But politically, at least so far, that was just not that was a total non-starter. You had Pat Mulroy, who ran the water district in Las Vegas, southern Nevada, a very powerful figure in water politics for many years, actually proposing a pipeline from the Mississippi River. Now, I don't know that how realistic that is at this point either. As far as, you know, the selection of crops, you know, that's market driven. And I think people are really hesitant to tell farmers, no matter where they're located, what they can grow. They're going to go for the crops, you know, that
that produced the highest profit, which has actually created a kind of a vicious cycle during the drought, particularly with almonds, as one caller brought up.
That's 10% of the water use.
Yeah. What happens in a drought is that, I'm sorry, I don't want to take up more time than my share here, but very quickly what happens during a drought is farmers move to higher profit margin crops, which often are the permanent crops, the tree crops, which have to be watered year round, and so the price of water becomes more dear, and then they take more row crops out of production, move to more tree crops, and it's created a kind of a vicious cycle in some parts of California. Although some farmers have told me that actually net, tree crops don't necessarily use any more water than row crops, so you can argue that both ways.
And again, Craig Miller is science editor for KQED, and Ellen Hanick is senior fellow with the Public Policy Institute of California. Maybe you can answer this question, Ellen. It's a question that often arises. A listener says, how much water is lost to environmental causes specifically? How much more water would be available to farmers in the Central Valley if all the protective measures for fish were taken away?
Well, it's a hard question to answer because the way we measure the share of water that goes to the environment is a little tricky. I mean, if you look at the Department of Water Resources estimates, they say on average about half of all available water every year is used for the environment. But a lot of that water does double duty. And just as an example, water is sent from reservoirs out through the delta toward the Golden Gate Bridge. That's done for two reasons. It's done both to keep the water in the delta not too salty so that it can be used by cities and farms around the state, and it also serves a purpose of helping some of the fish there. So it's a kind of, it counts as environmental water, but it's also good for other purposes. A lot of the environmental water, about half of it, is in the northern part of the state in wild and scenic rivers, and it's just kind of not connected to the rest of the system. So, some people dream about reconnecting those rivers to the rest of the system and taking that water out of there. But that was a battle fought a long time ago, and I think it was Governor Reagan who signed the act to protect those rivers.
Michael Carlin, I got a tweet here from a listener named Sherry who says, hotels seem to have unlimited use of water. When will they be restricted to 5-minute showers like everybody else?
Actually, they don't have unlimited water, but that's where the price signal really comes in because they run on a profit margin. And as the price of water goes up, they will start doing things. So, you go to a hotel now, they say, hang your towel back up. We won't change your bed or other things unless you ask us. So that's one area that really does take into consideration conservation based on economics.
Yeah, we're getting a number of listeners talking about the use in hotels. And let me get to another caller. Todd joins us next. Todd, welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning.
Morning.
I keep reading in the news about how they want to build this high-speed rail system between Los Angeles and San Francisco at about a $50 billion price tag. Why couldn't we just build some desalinization plants off our coast and go ahead, we create some jobs that way, and we have water? I mean, Saudi Arabia, Israel, they all get basically all their water from these plants that manufacture fresh water.
Well, there's going to be a big one in San Diego. I mean, it's underway, in fact.
It's going to be online this summer.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic, but at the same time, I mean, if we're going to be in these dry conditions now, and this seems to be the future trend here, why don't we go ahead and plan a little more aggressively for this situation?
Yeah, Ellen?
Well, Australia had a mega drought in the first decade of this century, and all of their major cities built big desal plants in the midst of that drought. Most of those plants are not operating now. Once the drought ended, because just the operating costs alone of desal are quite high just because it takes a lot of energy to produce it. So it's a reliable source of water, but it's an expensive source of water.
Yeah, I'm looking at a comment here, Craig Miller, from a listener who says, 50 minutes of program so far on our water crisis and not one word on the air about overpopulation, despite California's population increasing by a factor of 6 since I was born here. It's a real factor. There's no denying it.
Well, it is. I mean, and it's often cited as a reason why this drought is being considered so much more serious than the previously worst drought in recent memory, which was 1976-77. And the simple reason is because there's 20 million more people in the state than there were at that time. So the demand for water is logarithmically higher than it was then. So that's absolutely true. And as California's population expands, we're going to have to plan for this. We're going to have to, I think, pretty much overhaul completely the way we've been doing things as far as water conservation and distribution is concerned. And that, by the way, a quick plug here, if you go to our website, kqed.org/science, we just did a major feature on the desal question and what the pros and cons are and why we're not seeing more of it.
Do you want to add a final word here, Michael Carlin?
Yeah, the population question is a great one because water use in 76, 77 was quite high. We were probably serving 265 million gallons per day. Today, you know, 2015, we're serving 203 million gallons per day, and the population has increased by about 20%. So we have more people using less water than they did back in the 70s. And so that's kind of a myth that the population is really driving water use.
Well, that'll be the final word here. I want to thank everybody for their participation in the program. You, our listeners, of course, but also our guests. We spoke with Congressman Jeff Denham earlier, and Craig Miller, our science editor, and Ellen Hanick from the Public Policy Institute of California, and Michael Carlin, who is Deputy General Manager of the San Francisco PUC. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. And a reminder that we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Our next hour is going to feature former Congressman from Massachusetts, Barney Frank. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our interns are Megan Sussman and Nunu Teo. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.